This is Eastman's Elevated Podcast. I have on great guests that are really knowledgeable, consistently successful. We're able to dive deep down the rabbit holes of these different subject matters of shooting, of physical fitness, of mental toughness and drive. All the different skills that make up a complete hunter that you can become.
Here's your host, Brian Barney.
Hey, what's happening, guys? Got a brand new Eastman's Elevated for you. So on today's podcast, I have on Jace Guymon. So I've been wanting to get Jace on the podcast for quite a while now, so super stoked to get him on. And the conversation did not disappoint. So I got to know him through the podcast, but this guy, he's been incredibly successful at harvesting giants. And that goes for bulls, that goes for bucks. Also does a bit of guiding, so is really good at getting his clients on good animals. So it just made for a great conversation, and it's all about, you know, how to find and how to harvest these giant bucks and giant bulls. So I really enjoyed the conversation. I know you guys will enjoy it too, and we'll get right into it. Just want to thank a couple sponsors. So I want to thank Savage for their sponsorship of the podcast. So Savage just builds great out-of-the-box accurate rifles. Built up a rifle a couple years ago. The thing was sighted in within a handful of shots. I didn't fight it at all. It gets along with every different ammo type and just shoots some incredible groups. Just made for a real accurate rifle with that composite stock. And they have a bunch of different models. And so you can get a different model that fits your budget or fits your preferences. So there at the office, we really like that 110 Ultralight. It's a great rifle. And with that rifle, you get the AccuTrigger and the AccuStock. So the AccuTrigger, you can adjust yourself for the trigger pull. AccuStock, you can adjust the length of pull, the comb height. So you can just make a real good-fitting, accurate rifle. So make sure to check those guys out and everything they offer over there at Savage Arms. I also want to thank Sig Sauer. So Sig Sauer optics are incredible. I really like their optics. And right now, for listeners of the podcast, we're doing a giveaway. So you can get their Zulu 6 HDX. So that's their image stabilizing binos. So all you have to do is click the link in the description of this podcast. I believe all you have to do is enter your email and you're entered into a drawing, and we're going to be giving some of those away. So make sure to get entered in and get that giveaway. And there's also a giveaway over on Eastman's Bow Hunting Journal that I do with Dan Bakar. So check that out as well. But Sig Sauer optics, they're just building great optics. Like, I really believe that Kilo 5K is the best rangefinder, especially for bow hunters. And I think it also is a great rangefinder for rifle guys as well. They have the app on your phone where you can get connected with the rangefinder in the app and tells you the exact hold for your rifle. For bow hunters, it's got a powerful laser that'll shoot through grass. I like the priority target mode on that rangefinder. Also, the same readings on light and dark targets. It also has the exact cut for up and downhill where you actually enter the speed of your bow, because 1 or 2 yards on the cut can make a huge difference, especially in the Western hunting scenarios that we're in. So, yeah, check that out. Again, the image stabilizing binos are incredible. Really like the 12x42s, also use the 16x42s. They have a pair of the 20s, and they also have a smaller pair of 10x32 as well, which I'm sure are good. I haven't been able to use the 10x32s, but in the previous model, I used those and really liked them. Also, make sure to check out their standard binoculars, which is crazy good glass. So I've really been impressed by these. The 15x56s on a tripod, they work really good. And then also they have a pair of 10x42s that are incredible as well. So check those out and everything that Sig Sauer is doing, spotting scopes, also doing scopes on rifles. So check those guys out. They're making an incredible product over there at Sig Sauer, and we really appreciate their support. Also want to thank Black Ovis. So Black Ovis is an internet retail shop. They carry all the top name brands as well as their own name brand. You can save 10% on your order. Just put in the promo code ELEVATED10 and get anything you need or any upgrades you need for next hunting season. They have a knowledgeable staff that can answer any questions as well. And they just do a great job, and we really appreciate their support over here at Eastman's Elevated. I also want to thank Camo Fire. So Camo Fire is an app that you can get, and you can save a pile of money on new hunting gear. There's 80 new hunting deals that come up every 24 hours. So just download that, watch the deals come up, and pick yourself up some new hunting gear. Over at Eastman's, we're cruising along here, writing for the magazines, Eastman's Bow Hunting Journal, Eastman's Hunting Journal. Check out the other podcasts. Again, that podcast with Dan Picard is Eastman's Bow Hunting Journal, and we have a giveaway going on that right now as well. So if you check that out, you can get entered into that drawing. You also check out the Huntsman podcast, Wingman, Eastman's Hunting Journal podcast ran by Ike. So we have a whole network of podcasts that you can listen to and check out and see if it fits. Along with that, we've also got our Beyond the Grid, so check out our YouTube. Just saw the fresh cut of a mule deer hunt from last season that'll be coming up on that channel. So, just search Eastman's Hunting TV on YouTube, and that'll pop up, and you can watch this past season of Beyond the Grid. And with that, it's a great conversation, a really fun podcast. I'm really glad that Jace took the time and was on and then shared so much great information. So I really enjoyed it. I think you guys will enjoy it too. Let's get right into it. So here we go. I'm your host, Brian Barney, Eastman's Elevated.
All right. Well, really nice to meet you, Jace. Yeah. You've been getting after it. You've been on my list of guests for quite a while, so I'm glad it finally worked out.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, you bet. I don't even know where to start exactly. Like, man, you sure get after it in the mountains. Are you located in Utah there?
Yeah, kind of southeastern Utah.
So. Okay. You kill some unreal bucks and bulls.
Yeah, I've gotten pretty, especially the last couple of years on the bucks. I've kind of cooled it down on the better bulls, but I kind of did a switch a couple of years ago from focusing on elk to focusing on the deer, and I really only hunt them archery, so same time frame, and so I kind of have to focus my scouting. I usually don't hunt too many days for myself, so kind of pick one and go for that. So
yeah, the guiding keeps you pretty busy during season, huh?
Yeah. I work a full-time job, so I'm a welder, fabricator, mm-hmm. and then I just use all my vacation and time that I can just dump to go hunting. So
It's pretty typical for a bow hunter that just structures his life to spend, you know, at least as much time as he can in the woods. I'm the same. I'm a carpenter, and so have a small construction company and then try to spend as much time out there as I can.
Perfect.
Yeah. Well, it looks like you kill a lot of them in that early season, man. That early season alpine attitude for those mule deer is sure a good chance to kill big ones, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. Love that you have the whole summer to scout and kind of spread out your time off when you're working and everything. You can actually find one and pattern it and then have a good chance of killing it. So
right on. Yeah, those last couple bucks are just absolutely unreal, man. So do you attribute a lot of your success to the summer scouting?
Yeah, typically. So this last year, my buck was just fluke luck. I've had a pin on my Google Earth for like 5 years that I hadn't made it to. I've never even hiked into the area. And then this year I scouted really hard, but we had a super hard winter in Utah, and so it just didn't work out. I didn't have a single buck over like 170. I had a couple like high 160s, one that I thought would be like 170 to 175, but he was in a really tough spot to hunt him. Like, he just fed out on a little sliver of open ridge, then he mostly lived in some dense pine. And so I basically didn't have any deer that I wanted to hunt, and so I just went to my old Google pins and said, I need to hit this spot, and hiked in opening morning and just lucked into the buck that I killed. So normally scouting, summer scouting, I've got the buck dialed, and I usually watch the deer for a couple of years before I actually kill it. This year wasn't the case, but everybody lucks out now and then. So
Oh, that's it. Well, it's still putting in all the work and then capitalizing on the opportunity. But that's really good when you can turn up a buck that you hadn't scouted. Like, and scouting works so good for those early season mule deer, like you say, because you can pattern them, locate them, pattern them. And it is nice because it doesn't seem like there's a lot of guys around the mountains. Now, it can definitely surprise you come season that there's more than just you that knows about a buck, but that's a whole different battle.
Yep. Definitely. Yeah. I've lucked out the last 2 bucks I've had totally to myself. So this last year, that one, I knew area totally blind. And I was the only one in there, not much sign of anyone else hunting it too much either. So
man, I love that. There's like still a lot of good places out there. And, you know, I've killed some really good bucks in high pressure units, but it's just not the experience I'm looking for either. Like, I'd rather chase that high 160s, 170s buck than you're talking about than like a giant one if I'm going to have to combat hunt. Like, I killed a really big, like a 210 off the Wasatch Front 1 year, but the pressure was intense, and I don't even think it was as bad as it is now, but it was like that buck really disappeared down in secondary living in August, you know? And it was like I saw him 2 times in 10 days of glassing, or 20 sessions, like glassing sessions. So they just disappear like that in those high pressure units. So it's just like good that those units still exist where you can find good hunting like that.
Yeah, I mean, every state, I think, has quite a few spots like that, really. Like Wyoming, huge, huge country. Colorado, huge country. Up in Montana is giant. In Utah, it feels smaller, but you can get into some pretty backcountry areas in every unit still. So it's just digging those spots out.
Dude, I think you're right. And I think, like, a lot of times the points don't justify the unit. It's like you can find a good buck anywhere in Colorado, anywhere in Utah, like you're saying. And so, you know, like after I killed that buck, you know, I'm always looking to like gain knowledge in these states and like learn these units that I really like to hunt. And yeah, last year I hunted a new unit as well in Utah. And man, I sure was impressed. It's like not known for being like the best mule deer unit or the biggest bucks, but sure found some slammers in there. I was impressed.
Yeah, for sure. That's like Colorado, for example. I kind of regret my history there. I've built 16 points, burned them on a premier unit on a second season hunt, and then I went and killed a great buck. He's 195 and change, but in that meantime that I killed that one buck, my brother went and hunted Colorado like 8 times, and he killed a buck every time, and he averaged like 182. So he like bucks in the time I killed my one.
Yeah, well, you did good, but there's definitely more than one way to skin a cat, for sure. Well, I bet you're more aggressive now with your Colorado apps.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I think I've hunted like 5 different units there in Colorado, and I've got one now that I really like that's a low point unit, and so hoping to get back in there this year. But I love all the vast backcountry. It seems like Colorado, man, they can just grow a big one anywhere there.
Yeah, the genetics are statewide. I mean, really, Utah and Wyoming as well. The genetics are pretty much statewide. It's just finding that one buck that slips through the cracks, but Colorado, it seems to happen a little more often.
Age class and genetics, right? Put those couple things together and boy, it can grow some bucks. So that winter hit you hard. Was that like hit you hard even in southern Utah? I know northern Utah was hit really hard, and you guys had a pretty bad bull die off too, which usually those bulls fare better in those bad winters.
Yeah, we had, it was pretty statewide. Like southern Utah, from like the, like I'd say the bottom third of the state, really didn't die off, but we still had, I'd say, stunted growth. It was just such a harsh winter, and so kind of crazy that even our desert units struggled a little bit, not nearly as much. I'd like the far southern units, it was probably more of an average year, because they're just too much snow. Like you'd think normally the moisture would be the golden ticket to a good year, but last year it hammered us. And yeah, the elk too, it was terrible on our elk. So mid-state up was just slammed. It was terrible growth year, a lot of die-off. Made it a tough year overall. So
Yeah, you think like those big moisture years, like I've seen it with antler growth, like in Colorado, like big moisture years, like half the bucks are non-typical and have extras and stickers and kickers. And then, a dry year, an average year, they might be all typicals, but maybe one or two. But it does like make such a difference, like the winter that you have and how those animals fared coming out of winter in the first part of spring. Like you're saying, like stunted growth. You would have thought Southern Utah would have had exceptional growth last year with all the moisture, but there's just so many variables to mule deer and to elk and things is you really don't know until you get out there and start looking around.
Yeah, exactly. Like everyone, especially the elk, like people, a lot of guys were worried about the deer, but because elk usually are more hardy. But what I saw was the bulls shed later rather than like mid to late March, most of the mature bulls being shed, some of them held on into April. And then normally by the time they shed, even mid early March, there's good green up coming up and they're eating that green grass, they're getting that high nutrient rich feed. And last year, it was like late April before any green up started. And so they were a full month into their usual growing cycle where they just still living on dead, yucky winter grass and just really, really detrimental to their growth. So.
Yeah, it makes sense. Yeah, if that winter holds on late, yeah, it's definitely going to stunt their growth. And, antlers are just a sign of the health of the animal too and the species in the area as well. It's like you can't those really big bucks and big bulls, they have giant bodies, right? I mean, for the most part, I killed a desert deer once that only weighed about 160 pounds and had a giant rack on him. But for the most part, it seems like these big mountain deer that you're targeting and I'm targeting seems like they just have giant bodies on them.
Oh yeah, that's this buck I killed last year, the taxidermist, he said it. So it was an early summer. I mean, I killed it the 1 week into the archery hunt, so it was like August 20 something, August 26th or 7th. Forget the date, but early August or late August, early season, and his neck was like 18 inches. And he's like, that's like for Utah, that's like a rut deer.
That's what
That's
I was
like
going to say.
early season Colorado, maybe you occasionally see a neck like that. But so I underguessed him. I thought he was like 180 to 185, and I kill him and he's 199 and change. And so yeah, easy to misguess those giant bodied deer too.
Man, they don't grow on the ground very often, but I did have one in Wyoming that did that to me that I actually passed on him, which was looking back on it, it's like one of the stupidest moves. He was like the camp buck. He like hung around camp and he shed his velvet around there and he was a great deer. And I probably would have shot him if I didn't know about so many other big deer, but I really thought he was 170s, maybe mid 170s. And then I got down to the end and I was the last couple days and I spotted him. I'm like, man, he sure looks like a good buck. I'm gonna go make a run at him. And, it was actually we called him the 10K buck because I had to jog like all the way around him and then got to him right at last light and I killed that buck and he was 192. It's like the
Oh,
worst I've ever like underjudged a buck in my life, but his ear to ear, tip to tip spread was 26 inches. He just had this
yeah.
giant donkey head on him and huge body, and I just way underjudged the bucks, and he's still like one of my better bucks to this day.
Yeah, for sure. That ear to ear thing, I think that's probably the main thing. Like this last year's buck, his was right at 26, and then the year before, I missed him by 10 inches as well. I was under and his ear to ear was like 25 and 5/8. So,
Well, that's a good problem to have. You'd rather have them go
yeah.
that way than the other way, right?
For sure. Yeah, that
Yeah.
other way sometimes really gets you a bit.
Oh, it can. It's usually with bucks, and I'm sure like you're getting so much experience with guiding and hunting, and I'm sure you're getting really good at judging them, and me too. I've killed a lot of bucks and looked over a ton of bucks, and I feel really confident in my judging skills. But what seems to get me are like the long-tined, not a ton of mass, like just that 4-year-old deer that's just starting to get there with just a giant frame on them. It seems like those are the bucks that I'll talk myself into, and not that I'm disappointed or anything, but those are the bucks that really fool me nowadays, it seems.
Yeah, that's the only thing I think that usually the kind of a baby face saves me there, but you can face body, old buck, I always underjudge him. I usually underjudge the older bucks just because they have that old look and so he's a big deer, but then You don't anticipate like a 24 inch plus tip to tip of his ears or nearly that big of a neck or anything like that. So those are the ones I think get me worse. But yeah, those long-tined willow ear bucks, that they look good sometimes, those deep forks.
They do. That's what's tricked me over the years. But you're right. It's like I look at the body nowadays and can really tell the age class of the buck by the body, and that'll key me into his antlers and what they're going to look like. That baby face that you mentioned, that's a good tip. I don't really key into that face or the Roman nose as much as I should. So that baby face, what do you see when you see like a baby face deer that's a 3.5 or 4.5 year old buck?
Yeah, just usually like less of a protruding brisket. Mm-hmm. Neck just looks thinner. It looks light, looks kind of dainty, more like a doe. And then the nose kind of just more of a point. It just cones down rather than having that kind of blocky nose, almost a square nose coming out.
Okay.
And that's one of my things I try to look at first, just especially on some of the more premium units. Like I guide a Henry Mountains deer hunter, like those bucks have phenomenal genetics. And so there might be a high 190s buck, but he looks like a 3-year-old. I'll usually try to look past him and find something better and something older. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of old bucks that peak out in that 190 range on the Henry's unit specifically. And so if I have a choice, I'll find one of those if it's a down year rather than a young buck that has potential. So,
man, that makes sense. It's like if you can let them grow up, they'll just grow into exceptional bucks. I found a buck one time that I didn't kill, and I really thought he was pushing like high 190s as a 4-year-old, and he had stickers and kickers, and he was a great buck. And I ended up killing his running mate because it was an older deer, and the running mate was like a 187. He was only 18 inches wide, like super tall, like just a great one. And then that buck, I drew the tag again and went back and found him like as an 8-year-old or 9-year-old or whatever age he was, and he exploded. He's still to this day like one of the biggest deer that I've ever chased, like a 230s, or they get that big and I'm not even good at judging them. Like I don't even know, but he had the same kickers and stickers and hanging just a couple drainages where I had found him 4 years earlier. It's like, man, if you can just let those 3 and 4 year olds grow with those good genetics, man, they can just balloon up into, you know, a once in a lifetime type deer.
I know. Yeah. And I don't know if it's necessarily that it's their peak potential, or if it's more environmental factors, but I've seen a couple of bucks. A good friend of mine 2 years ago, 2 seasons ago, killed a buck that basically had a 2-point mainframe. And from in 2015, he was probably like 150 inch 2-point with extras. And then we basically watched him every single year. My buddy picked up a couple of his sheds and other guys were hunting him. And 2017, he ended up being like a upper 160s, low 170s, big cheaters, great big 2-point frame with big cheaters. And then he shrunk 2018, 2019. And then what was it? I want to say it was 2022. 2021, whenever he killed him, we figured he was a 12-year-old buck, and he just blew up. He went from like a 160 to I want to say it was 187, and he had 2-point mainframe with like 9 inches of extra. He's 34 and a half inches wide, but as a 12-year-old, give or take a year, like we watched him for so many years, we knew pretty well exactly what he was. And he peaked as a 12-year-old, and I don't know if that's more environmental that year, just he wintered well, he fed well, and maybe he could have been his best year as like an 8-year-old, 9-year-old, like you'd expect, but he didn't have the feed to make it happen. I don't know, but sometimes a buck can peak pretty old, so it's cool to see him get that age.
That's really cool, man. That's wild to peak at 12 years old. Yeah, you think he'd be going downhill by then, especially like a public land deer like that. Yeah, that's wild, man. These big deer, like you spend so much time in these really good units, and then, you know, of course you're hunting for yourself and you hunt mule deer every single year. So I'd venture to bet like you're hunting a lot of the easy to draw or even general season hunts in other states and things of that nature. So like, what do you think the key is to locating these big deer? Is it like time in there? Is it knowledge throughout your years of hunting and guiding and things? Or what do you think the key is to turning up like these exceptional animals and being able to arrow them?
I'd say probably time, like just a lot of time in the units, a lot of local knowledge, just general knowledge of an area. I focus on probably three general units, and those three general units I know extremely well. I know, I mean, I've hunted border to border of those units. I know the whole unit. Obviously, there's spots within them that you could learn that, you know, I don't know every little pocket or whatever, but just like this last buck, I had never been to that spot, but you kind of get an idea what areas have the bigger potential. Like maybe it borders some private, maybe it borders a big deep canyon that is just tough to hunt, or, you know, there's a lot of factors you can look for. But then I think a big factor that maybe a lot of people is where they miss out. Maybe they see that big buck, they glass him up and they see him one time, but then they go back three times and they don't see him again in those next three visits to that area. He's still there. You just didn't see him. And I think a little dedication to hunting a specific animal is kind of a key factor that a lot of guys maybe miss out on.
It makes sense. So, yeah, you mentioned like bordering private or bordering a big drainage. And so like you've got a feel for where the bucky terrain is. And I'm sure where you found bucks in the past is where you'll find bucks now. Like that's your working knowledge that you're talking about. And then like your pin that you killed that great big one out this year. So that was a spot that was just on your list. Do you find that bigger bucks are going to be in more secluded spots, tougher to glass, or is it about covering country, glassing a lot from your truck at like the right times or short trips to the vantage point, or is it like all of the above, like you could find them anywhere?
I'd say all of the above. You could really like that giant 2-point. I mean, a lot of guys knew about him. He's over 30 inches wide for 5 years on a public land general unit in Utah and a very popular unit, and you could glass him easily. There was a road that two different roads you could glass this buck from, and they go right to the rim. You don't even got to get out of your vehicle and you could glass him. But then it was like a 3-mile walk to hunt him, and he lived in a little pocket of Quakeys, and he basically would run loops around people in that little super thick old growth Quakey patch. And I just think it, you know, it was just a hard place to kill a deer. And so people might see him, but they're like, ah, it's a long walk. I've hunted him 4 times and I never caught a glimpse of him over there. But then like my buck last year, he was a very, very long walk and zero glass ability to that spot. You have to hike in there, and then there's one little knob you could kind of glass it. But even right where he lived, I didn't ever glass him up. Well, one morning I glassed him from that spot, that little knob, but pretty much unglassable. So I think just a little luck, you know, a little bit of all those factors combined, and a big buck can slip through anywhere. So
makes sense. It's like, you know, you get such a good overview of the unit when you can use the road system and be able to find vantage points off that or short hikes away. And then too, I like to, you know, hike back in there and find those places that bucks can grow up, tough to glass spots. But, you know, a giant that I found last year that I'd hiked way in and up to the ridge and over the top and slept at 12.8 and, you know, like all this stuff. And then I glass him right above a trailhead, and he's just like just around the corner from the trail. So just like a little bit out of everybody's effort to go glass into that little basin. And that's where he was making his living at. And they do get really good at making a living in these spots. So, man, that's super interesting. So when you say that you think guys make mistakes by seeing that buck once and then not seeing him the next 3 times, and you talk about that dedication, like I find that, you know, some bucks live in the same drainage and that's where their home range is, and they may live only in 400 square yards, like a spot like that. Or I find a lot of times that bucks will use a couple, 2-3 different drainages and kind of move in between those. So when you say guys aren't finding those bucks or putting enough time in when they locate that buck, like how would you go about it? If you knew a big buck was in the area, you know that that's his core area for the early season, so you're going to put a ton of your focus in there. Are you going to keep going to the same vantage point at the right time? Are you going to find different vantage points that kind of show off different drainages and look around that area? Or what exactly do you mean, like, when you think guys aren't putting forth that effort to turn that buck up again?
Yeah, I think so. Like, my buck 2 years ago, he was a super small home range. He pretty much lived one big drainage, and then there's like a little face set of canyons that he lived in, and then the edge of one other big drainage, kind of a mile and a half tops, like maybe even under a mile area that was his core area. But I only seen him a couple of times. Like, I'd glass from this angle, then I'd work this angle, and I just hammered like onyx and things, trying to find angles to look into where he was. And I'd only seen him a few times, but then I'd hike in, I put a trail camera in, and I put a camera right where I'd seen him. So I seen that buck for 4 years in a row. The fourth year is when I killed him. And I put a camera right in what I thought was his bedroom, and I never got a single trail camera picture of that deer. But I glassed him up less than 100 yards above my camera two or three times. And so I think it's just, once you see that deer, you know, realize usually a big buck got big because he's smart. He's probably not traveling too far. He's going to be in there. And so you look at water sources, look at bedding areas, and just play all of, use every card in your deck to get on him.
Yeah, it makes sense. Like, time is such a huge factor to killing these giant bucks and bulls, isn't it? It's just like having the time. And I'm sure you find that guiding too. It's like just putting in your time, you know, in the right areas, and you turn them up. Yeah, I like that. I like knowing that buck's there and just not giving up on them, just continuing to search them out. And bucks are strange too, is like, they're not always on their feet for the first hour of the day. Sometimes they can be bedded down in that, or they can really change their behavior. And especially as they start to shed that velvet and go into secondary living, they can really get tough, as they hardly show during daylight hours. And then, man, they just hold to that timber more. So I guess that's like part of the lure, right? It's like they're so difficult to kill. They just get so slick.
Yeah. Yeah. And like you're saying, that secondary living, usually it's not far removed from where they've been all summer. You've been watching them in the velvet. They just are kind of dumb sitting out on that open side hill where you can see them. And then they strip the velvet and bam, they're, all they do is they move 200 vertical feet. They're just down below in that thick pocket, and they never come out of it. So it's kind of, that's, I think, realizing big bucks usually have small range is something that for me is really, really been paying off the last couple of years. I've always killed bucks. I've never not filled a tag, but every year I've slowly been trying to get bigger and bigger. And the last couple of years, I finally got into the class of buck that I think, you know, I don't think I'll ever grow out of. You know, a 180 inch plus deer is so rare, and that's kind of what I'm shooting for. And to find that class, I don't think any of them that I've hunted so far have had a big home range. And so just, you know, really hammering where you've seen that one big buck. So
yeah, dude, that's absolutely exceptional. They're so tough to arrow a buck of that caliber, you know, just to find and hunt a buck of that caliber. It's so impressive, man. Yeah, I really like what you're saying about that home range too. And then the secondary living as well. It's like, it's wild. They don't have to move far to that secondary living, you know, and they still come out in openings and shoots and slides. They just stick to the cover more, in my experience. And like, yeah, you know, I've seen them like you where they drop 200 yards. I've also seen them where they drop like about 1,000 feet in elevation. And so I hunted this one spot in Wyoming 1 year. And so like I had a Colorado and a Wyoming tag the same year, and it's the same window to hunt both of those tags. So I was really pressed for time, but the Wyoming unit is like 3 hours away from my house. So I had scouted in there, and well, you know, like Wyoming country, and you know, good buck country, like, and especially the 2010s were insane for mule deer. And so like I had probably scouted like, I'll say 150 bucks, maybe it was 100 bucks, but there was bucks in every drainage in every spot up here that I had scouted. And I had scouted a couple really good bucks. And I got up there, and I was up there like September 5th or 6th by the time I hunted Colorado and got back to that spot. And you couldn't find a buck in the high country. Like, I was blank. I think I found one small 4-point, 150 inches. Like, I know there's 100 bucks in this country. Like, where are they at? And I finally found him by like what you're saying is like dropping 1,000 feet to like off the main ridge down a spur ridge and just getting a different vantage point. And pretty soon there was bucks everywhere down there in those timbers and chutes and slides. And then, you know, finally ended up killing one deep in the hunt. But yeah, that secondary living can be tough, but those bucks are still there. And you hunt a lot of that too. Like you said, you hunted Colorado second season with all those points you spent. So you've hunted them in that secondary living as well. It is a challenge, but man, I love to chase hardhorns.
Oh yeah, I always bow hunt because it's my passion. You know, I love to bow hunt mule deer. I love to bow hunt elk, but I kind of hate velvet, to be honest. Like, I way prefer hardhorn. And so yeah, that like that second season Colorado or the October rifle in Utah, like those type of hunts are just so fun. And getting into that secondary living, I love still hunting, just sneaking through the pines, easing through, and you know that's a big deer area, so you just, you know, really ease through the pines. You got the gun off the shoulder and looking, or you know, you got your bow ready and you're just ready for that opportunity. But kind of jump shooting deer, that's fun. I love that type of hunting too. So
mm-hmm. Yeah, I bow hunt them exclusively, but I love, you know, I'll hunt like elk during September. Like there's nothing I'd rather be doing, you know, once it gets to about the 10th of September on to our season goes to like October 15th. So that's pretty much dedicated to elk in one to two states. And then I'm back to mule deer, and I like them in that secondary living, like finding them in that late October staging for the rut. I have some pretty good hunting. And then I love like the rut opportunities with my bow. It's like, it's tough to kill a big one, but it's so thrilling and exciting, like chasing those bucks when they're after does. And there's some good opportunities out there. So I love chasing them during the rut and even into late season. And, you know, it can get tricky in the snow with a bow and arrow. Just that crunch can kill a guy. But I love chasing those things, like as a hardhorn, like whether it's pre-rut or during the rut, or they're fun to chase all times of the year. But I agree with you that I think that early season alpine living for mule deer is like the best chance at a big one. That's where, you know, my biggest deer have come from for sure.
Yeah, definitely. It's a lot easier, but like you're saying, the snow, even for elk, that's Utah just did added a late season elk archery hunt. I think the success rate, Utah gave like 80, I think it's 87 tags to that hunt, and like 17 guys killed a bull. It was super low success. And considering like, it was probably more of your top end hunters, like guys that take it pretty serious. Your killers, like, you know, a lot of guys always say killers kill. And I feel like it was probably the killers that got that tag, and mm-hmm. still super low success. So yeah, the snow, it can make it tough.
Dude, you're so right. It's like, I have a buddy that's a dang good elk hunter, a good hunter all the way around, but he's just killed great bulls just year after year. And sometimes he turns them up in units that I can't even believe he turned them up in, you know. But yeah, he got lucky and somebody had turned back in one of those premium late season tags that they started in Utah last year. And there wasn't many non-resident tags. There was like a couple or something. And he got that tag and he hunted it really hard and got after him. And I know he made plays and stuff. Stocks on bulls, but yeah, came home empty-handed, which isn't the usual for this guy, man. He is a killer. And yeah, I think it's just a high degree of difficulty and tough. Like I cut my teeth like hunting bulls like in that post rut. Like here in Montana, they used to have a general rifle, and when I used to hunt with a rifle, it's how I gained a lot of my experience. Those bulls were really tough, as they just like disappear in those pockets and things, and you know, it's fairly high pressure as well. And you know, I've often thought about like doing some of those late hunts in Arizona, but I just can't quite burn my points. It's like the time to hunt elk is during the rut with my bow, I feel like.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Every year I swear I'm going to go do like a rut deer hunt in Arizona, get that mm-hmm. over the counter tag. But then I burn all my available time off hunting either for myself early or for clients during the rut, or, you know, early season bucks, something. So I just never get around to it. But yeah, like September was built for hunting elk, like early September 1st to the 10th. That's my time. I'm out hunting elk every year. That's my favorite window.
Good for you. Yeah, so like those big bulls, like you've also killed a bunch of giant bulls. Like how do you view like hunting elk versus hunting mule deer? Is it the same, like really tough to turn up a big one, or is it that, you know, I feel like elk is just like, it's different. It's herd dynamics and you have all the eyes of the cows. And I feel like it's like less of this methodical, planned out stalk, tiptoeing in. It's more like get over there and adapt to the situation. And you definitely have to keep the element of surprise. And those elk are definitely switched on. But how do you view it, like killing a trophy elk versus killing a trophy mule deer?
Yeah, I love hunting elk, but I have way more respect for a big mule deer. Like killing elk, I feel like for myself, finding a bull that's, you know, worthy of the arrow, you know, a big mature bull is 95% of the battle. And I don't know, my hunting method for a big elk for myself is kind of unique. I basically just run. Like my first really good bull I killed back in 2016, his 356, an over-the-counter Utah bull. And basically I had hunted this bull. I called him the ghost bull because I had trail cam pictures of him for like 4 years before. And so he actually shrunk a little bit from the year before to the year I killed him. But I'd never seen him during the hunt. I'd get trail cam pictures. He'd be right in this area that I knew like the back of my hand. And then he would just disappear. And then maybe he would roll back through like early October and I'd have him on a trail camera again. But I just never seen him during the hunt. And then this one day, there was a storm. I just got done guiding. I guided a desert sheep in southern Utah. It was the governor's tag. And so we could start hunting September 1st. We killed September 1st, or the 2nd, I think. I think we killed September 2nd. Clear down in Zion, the far southern border of the state. And so it's like 3.5 hour drive. We kill, I go check him in with the division. And then I looked at the weather and it showed just storms rolling over where I wanted to hunt. So I jump on the road, haul butt, got to the unit, parked my truck, went running down a ridge, like 1.5 miles from the truck. And I throw a bugle out. And so September 3rd, one bugle, and this bull just rips the bugle back. And so I just started sprinting, like literally sprint fast as I could. He was probably 800-900 yards when he bugled. I run as hard as I can right towards him. And I get to probably 100-150 yards, and I'm starting to see cows through the trees. So I slow down. And then I rip another bugle, and he bugles like right here off to my side, like 180 degrees from this cow. So I just walk 20 yards forward. Now I know I'm in between some of the cows and him. And I do a cow call and then a bugle, and he just comes running at me, comes running into 58 yards, starts raking a tree, and I thumped him. Perfect broadside, 58-yard shot, and done. So that memory will forever be one of my favorite elk hunting memories because it's this bull I'd never seen, and just the stars aligned. But
that's so killer, man. Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, I feel like elk are meant to be hunted aggressively, and not recklessly, but aggressively. And you kind of get to know what you can get away with and what you can't when you're hunting elk. And so, you know, I'm always pushing the boundary. But if I hear a bull or see a bull that I want to go after, I'm going to go get in there and see if I can make something happen. And like I say, I'm not going to be reckless with the wind and there is a time to like close on elk where you do run quite a bit, like whether you're trying to cut them off or like, you know, I've killed some great bulls that I'm like coyoting or shadowing that just go over the ridge and then I'll sprint to that ridge and pop over the top and they're in bow range. And so and then sometimes I'll have to sit still motionless for a half an hour because a cow like caught me moving or whatever. But I feel like elk are meant to be hunted aggressively, which is like a really fun way to hunt. And I hunt like rutting mule deer similar to elk, and yeah, it just makes for a real thrilling and exciting hunt. So, and I want to mention before we get to the end of the podcast too, is to go check out your YouTube. You have any of those hunts on your YouTube?
So I'm working on getting some of the deer hunts up. I'm terrible at videoing, but like I lucked out and drew a Utah bison tag, archery only on the Book Cliffs unit, and I killed a really good bison with my bow down there, and that's on YouTube. And then quite a few other shot, some kill shot compilations. Those get me in trouble on the YouTube. They take away your monetizing and everything, but they're fun to watch. So
oh, that's I've got killer. Those. Yeah. So go check them out over at Jay Steinman Hunting and check out some of those hunts. Yeah, I saw that bison, man. That was incredible. So yeah, super cool. Yeah, that videoing's tough. I always thought, like, you know, I do the coolest adventure hunts, and if I could just video it, like, it would be the most epic videos. And then, you know, I'd go and turn the video camera on and forget how to talk into that thing, or like, I'd, you know, I get home and I see all my footage and try to edit to get it together, and it's like, God, that wasn't what I experienced or what I thought I had. It really takes a long time of like working with that camera, a little bit of editing to figure out what you need to be able to make a film, getting comfortable with that thing, and then two, like pulling out that camera when you don't want to pull it out, when something goes wrong, or you know, you blow a stock or what. But that makes for good film. But yeah, I think it's like anything, that you just got to spend time doing it and working with it. And then, you know, solo filming is so difficult. Like you know, Remy is like a buddy of mine, so good at it, you know. And so I've definitely solo filmed a handful of hunts, and I'm getting better. I put out a goat hunt last year that turned out really cool. But yeah, it's like, it definitely doesn't come natural for me either. It's taken a lot of work.
Yeah, it's, I need to work a lot harder on it. I'd say I'm still pretty, I wouldn't even call me a novice at the video side of things yet. The only thing I'm good at is getting the kill shot. Like when I'm helping someone else, I always get the phone scope thrown on my spotter, and I get the shot on video, but I'm pretty bad at any of the storyline. It's like, oh, here's the apex of the whole thing, video done, no story. So,
well, it's a tough balance, right? Between being present in the moment and really enjoying the thrill of the hunt, and then trying to capture it on video. It's like a fine line, right? It's like, you don't want to be the guy that's constantly pulling up Instagram stories, or, you know, that's like constantly filmed. Oh, like, you also want to be immersed in the experience too. So that's what I struggle with quite a bit as well, is like, when I'm in the hunt, I'm in the hunt, which makes it nice if I have a cameraman that's then focused on capturing the film. But there too, then you're trying to sneak two guys in. And I feel like, you know, filming public land, bow hunt, do it yourself, or they're like, that isn't the norm for the videos that we see that are put out. Like, man, it's so extremely difficult. It's difficult by myself without a camera. Like, you throw another camera in, it just really ups the degree of difficulty on there, and can get frustrating at times when I, you know, when I really like to chase and kill trophy critters.
Yeah, exactly. That's like the aggressive hunting style. I'm probably overly aggressive sometimes. It's paid off, but I've definitely bumped some animals that I shouldn't have. I run it out a lot. They're noisy animals. I don't ever sneak on a bull until, you know, that last little bit to get the shot. But as far as getting within that initial first like glimpse of the bull, I'm like a fast jog plus every time. And so to think of a video camera, I just never do it. I tried putting a GoPro on the front of my stabilizer, and that worked all right. But then I'm always running out of battery, and it's, you know, you got such a broad angle video, it doesn't really turn out. So
no, I did that last year too. I had a cameraman for a week and couldn't get the bull I wanted killed, and then he took off, and sure enough, a couple days later, I killed him. And so I had it on GoPro and things, but he just looks like I'm shooting 200 yards at him with my bow, you know, it's like 50 yards away and heart shot him. But yeah, it's just, oh man, it's yeah, it's tough with the GoPro to have that be your primary footage. But yeah, it's all in good fun, and it sure is. It sure is killer when you can like capture a hunt and put it together and be able to show family and friends and show that experience. So it is rewarding too, but can definitely be frustrating at times. But yeah, I like hearing about like your elk hunting style of being extremely aggressive, like quite possibly more aggressive than I am on there. And we all have to build our own hunting style, our own preferences. Like I have a buddy that's super aggressive and like probably more aggressive than me, and he does bump some critters, and it's like tough to hunt with him because I'm just a little bit more patient. But he always runs into critters, he always kills, it always works out, like you know, and he may bump one and then he'll get on another one down the ridge or whatever. And then I have another buddy that's so patient and hunts so slow that it drives me nuts. It's like we can't ever get anywhere because he's constantly sneaking and glassing, and it's like, can we move somewhere? And it works for him. He's like a killer and kills stuff. So yep. I think you really got to build like your own personal preference or style of hunting that works for you. And yeah, and you learn along the way. Like sometimes I'm too aggressive or all bump elk, and I think, God, I really should have slowed down 100 yards before that when I heard them bugle that last time, or whatever the case is. But I really think you have to build your own style of hunting that works for you.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, I think like your whole hunting style has to, you know, coincide with each other. For example, my bow setup, I shoot a high poundage bow, but I shoot a pretty light arrow. Everything's designed for like speed and, you know, a lot of range error capability, a lot of, you know, I can shoot through really tight gaps, kind of all meshes well and it works for me. And it may not be right for everyone. I mean, I'm shooting a, what is it, 417 grain arrow, but that's what I killed my bison with. And it, I mean, I got 24 inches of penetration with a 2-inch cut expandable broadhead. And so it works. I've got plenty of energy, everything, but I'm all about like shot opportunity. I don't want to miss because I've only got a 16-inch window to shoot through at this bull because I may have been overly aggressive and I didn't stop at that little meadow where I knew I was going to get the wide open, perfect shot. And it works. It's definitely, I won't say it's the way for everyone, but it works for me. So.
Oh, dude, that makes so much sense. Yeah, you got your setup like geared towards the style of hunting that you like to do. And that range forgiveness is so key, man. It doesn't take the heaviest arrow in the world to kill those big critters. Dude, I've got a 26.5-inch draw length, so I've got it like a woman or a kid's draw length, you know, so I lose like so much energy there. And then, you know, I shoot a 450 grain arrow, but I mean, it passes through everything. I mean, it gets great penetration and kills everything I shoot at, but I think that range forgiveness is so important, and especially with today's push on elk for those super heavy arrows and for those cut on contact fixed blade heads. It's like, man, I've killed about every animal there is with a good expandable that does a bunch of damage, and I actually think that's a more forgiving head because it does do more damage if you miss, you know, lungs, heart, or liver. You got a better chance to get them. But yeah, I think that's important. So like, how do your guide clients mesh with your style of hunting? Do you just like get them into your style and like that's the way you know how to be successful? Do they kind of start believing in it once you start getting them into elk, or do you tame it down a little bit, or how do you hunt when you're guiding?
So that's, unfortunately, with Utah, I mean, with the point structure, most of my clients are older. So I've guided several gentlemen in their 70s with archery equipment. And so obviously then you have to totally adjust that style. They can't run a mile down a ridge and then drop into the canyon at a run down a almost vertical hill. And so I've had to totally adjust that. And so I can hunt a lot of styles, but I definitely notice a decrease in my success when I have to adjust and go to that more just methodical, like work in on the animal method. But, you know, I have had a couple of clients. I guided a guy that was like phenomenal shape. He had played soccer in college and things, and we basically sprinted after this bull. He was on a lower tier unit, and we killed like, I think it's 347, really good bull. Mm-hmm. But we had to dog him like down to the bottom, up to the top, down to the bottom, and it was brutal. We did like 4,500 vertical in a day.
Wow.
Staying on this bull, and then he ends up arrowing him at like 52 yards after the whole day of just dogging him, and it worked. Like, he was pushing his cows. He wasn't responding to calls at all. And so we just had to keep trying to cut him off, and we'd be barely too slow, or a cow would spot us or something. And it worked. We were able to hunt my normal style, and we got him killed. But then that same year, I guided a guy that was 76 years old, and he killed a great bull. He killed a 336 bull, but I ended up putting him in I made a ground blind out of trees above a wall, and we just sat in that until a bull came in. And so, you know, sometimes you got to adjust, especially when you're helping someone else, but it can all work out. So
yeah, it's really smart. Like, you're able to adapt to the client that you have, and you may not get like as many opportunities, but you know, it's like, you just know that adapting to his limitations and what he can do is going to make you guys successful in the end, if you put in your time, man. Yeah, that's really cool. Boy, I bet that guiding has made you really good at your own hunting too. It's like experience is just the best teacher out there, and it's the information day and age, and there's a lot of information, but you got to figure out a way to apply that information to your own hunting. So, man, I bet that guiding, even though you're not always hunting for yourself, but you're always in the hunt, I bet you that's made you way better at your scouting and hunting. And what about like keeping your cool during the shot? As I bet you've seen everything under the sun. Like, man, it's not easy to execute a shot with a rifle or with a bow, and you have to fail and miss a bunch. So I'm sure you've been able to see that with your clients and probably cut the learning curve for yourself. But how big of an impact has that been to your hunting?
Oh yeah, it's definitely been huge. And I think another aspect, not just the time in the field, because obviously that's the best learning tool, but also rubbing shoulders with these other guys that are just straight killers. Like it's just like a podcast like this. Like you can learn a lot of information, but I think it's a whole nother level when you're actually in the field, you're side by side with this other guy that he is just a phenomenal hunter. And so guiding alongside other guides, guys that know how to get it done, that's helped a lot as well. But yeah, it's been huge to my personal hunts. I'd say definitely probably the biggest factor in my success today, like at the level anyways, is rubbing shoulders with these other guys and also seeing so many different scenarios unfold. That's been huge. Being on all these hunts, so.
It's really cool, like picking up so much information from other good killers, like just hanging out and, like you say, rubbing shoulders and like talking story with them, or like talking strategy and being able to run things across them. And also they're like hunting in the same terrain that you are, so a lot of that information is gonna transpose to the country that you're hunting as well. Man, that makes really good sense. And what do you think about like execution? I'm sure you've seen arrows go everywhere under the sun. Like, what's been the key to your success of like keeping your cool? Big bucks and big bulls, like, man, they'll rattle the best of us shooting at them. So what would you say like your shooting process is, or like how have you gotten so good at closing the deal on these big animals?
Well, I don't know. I've definitely had my share of misses back in the day. I haven't, well, so my last two bucks have kind of been a mess on, but both just environmental factors that I just didn't pick up on. I missed a range error on this big buck last year. I actually missed him the first stock. I think a big part is I have a really high success rate on stocks. I'm like 95% of my stocks I get an arrow loose, and so I can afford a miss occasionally, but not that you ever want to think that way. But yeah, I got just a range error on that buck, and then I missed him again the next time, and that was just a tiny little quakey branch that it looked invisible. I didn't even see it. It was that the buck was at like 72, and the branch was at like 50 something, and just one of those gray branches sticking down and on an angle, and I didn't even see it. And so and that one I actually hit him in the horn. So I did hit him with that arrow, but just two misses on a buck that size, that you should be done. And I lucked out and got a third opportunity and made a good shot. But I think watching guys do, like you say, every scenario under the sun, seeing, draw too early and then you're shaking and you have to let down, or draw too late and the bull sees you, or just anything. I think something that helped me was probably like 6 7 years ago. It was actually Dan Evans posted, really, really big elk hunter, killed a lot of big bulls. He posted his own. He had a his like aim, settle, really some this little thing he wrote on the riser of his bow. And I just basically adopted my own version of that, and that helps. Just you practice, you shoot 1,000 arrows, but if you're thinking through the process every practice shot, rather than, because it gets down to muscle memory when I'm just practicing. I draw, aim, shoot, nail the target. I practice really far ranges. I shoot out to 140 preseason. That way, when I get a 70-yard shot, it looks, right there. But it's all so muscle memory that then when you get a buck in front of you, I feel like, your muscle memory almost forgets. You got that quiver going on, and you gotta have something else. And so having that little recitation in my head, that really helped me. And so that might be seem dumb. It might not work for everyone. That's definitely helped me.
Dude, that's totally it. Yeah, it's like keeps your focus there, you know? And so if you practice that during high pressure situations, like in your practice, but also shooting with your buddies, also shooting under pressure, shooting 3Ds, and you have this mental recall, okay, draw, anchor, put the pin where it needs to go, pull, 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 shot breaks, you know? And so, yeah, you can do that on animals. And it's just good to hear that another killer, like, has the same, like, that you've missed. Like, I missed a buck due to a branch in the shadows at about the same yardage as you did on that buck last year. Same thing. He stood up in the shadows, and it looked like I could have drove a school bus through the opening I had. And pull, 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 and execute, and that shot just nicked a branch coming in that I had no idea was even there. And so, you know, weird stuff happens, but it's really tough to transition being a good shooter on a target to being a good shooter on animals. And I think that's like the real secret. So I think like that, you know, that mental, you know, walking yourself through that focus of that shot, talking yourself through the shot when you get in those high pressure moments, I think that really helps. And then I also like what you said, like, you're able to be cool, calm, and collected when somebody else is shooting. Like, you still get excited, but it's like if I'm stalking with somebody else, I get to be the voice of reason. I get to be cool, calm, and collect. And I think that carries over into my own hunting as well, as like I know how to kind of be cool and calm during my shot or whatever. And so, you know, I think failure is the prerequisite to success. And so I think we have to miss, and it hurts and it cuts deep, but we get better for it. And like eventually we just turn ourselves, you know, into consistently successful shooters, or like you start to get the hang of it where, you know, the shot just starts to come together. You walk yourself through the shot, but you know, you actually look at your pins, or you don't get too excited where you don't line up your peep. You start paying attention to the little details. You mentioned the range. Dude, I think range finding is an art that nobody talks about. It's like to be able to get a good range and barely come up over the rise or over the grass, to hit them multiple times to make sure you have the right range. Like, man, it's an art just to have the right range. And even with range forgiveness, when we're shooting these longer yardages, if you're off by a yard or two, you're going to miss, you know? So, man, that's a huge part of it. But yeah, it sounds like your journey is real similar to mine.
Yeah, there's so many factors to it. It really comes down to that experience. And like this last buck, that first morning, I pop out over a little rise. I look down 200 yards away, and there he is feeding us. Holy cow, that's a big deer. You just got this frame wiggling through the brush, and then I eased down. I got in. I want to say I was 64 yards is what I ranged. Well, I hit it like three times. Like, I thought I was solid aim. I hit my anchor. I'm calm because I had all day. I mean, he was just feeding. He had no idea I was there. I hit my anchor. I'm focused. I break the shot, and he jumped like he had been hit, and he ran off. Holy cow! I just killed a giant, and then nothing, you know. And then I ended up putting my backpack right where he was standing, but higher, and I had just hit the bush. I just got a bush, and I shot right under him. He must have been like 74 something, you know, and I was picking up that bush consistently. And so, yeah, that range and just having that practice. And the same 2 years ago, that big buck I got 68 yards in his bed, same thing. I thought I had all day. He kind of caught me drawn, but he was just standing up out of his bed. And so he was just standing there kind of hard quartering two shot, looking at me. But, you know, when they're looking at you, but they don't know. Mm-hmm. He's not spooked. And so I'm just anchored, holding perfect amount of time, I thought, released. And then just one little branch. And I actually hit him perfect. The branch was only like maybe 10 inches out in front of him, but it just cocked my arrow sideways, so it hit him without the momentum behind it. And so I only got like 6 inches of penetration. And so I picked up one lung. He was hurting, but I had to track him a long ways and put a follow-up shot. But, you know, it can happen to anyone, but just keeping that, you knowing that you're good, like, you know, crap happens, and not letting it affect your next shot, that's big as well. And so just opportunities, I think the more you can get behind your bow, especially at live targets, there's a big difference between a foam and even like a pig. If you can go hunt pigs or something, I think that could be really helpful.
Dude, you're so right. So spot on. Yeah, it's, I always preach that, like, high opportunity hunts where you get to practice stalking and shooting. Like, I love, you know, axis deer on Hawaii, or like I cut my teeth like hunting a lot of antelope too, you know, like really practicing long shots and spot and stalk. And then, yeah, we could get like 5 whitetail doe counter over the counter tags. And so like every year I'd go hunt whitetail does spot and stalk on the ground. And that was like huge for my development as a bow hunter. So yeah, I definitely think you're right, man, is that trigger time is like so important on those things, and getting that experience and yeah, learning from it as well. And the devil is in the details. I also like how you said, like, forget the last shot. You like have to. It's like, you know, I doubt Tom Brady remembers all the interceptions he throws when he's trying to throw for a touchdown. You know, it's like you just got to forget the last shot and just move on. And sometimes weird stuff can happen where you came off your back wall and you fired an arrow 10 feet over his back. You just got to forget it. You got to get back out and get another, earn another opportunity. So, yeah, man, you're spot on. Like, so like, you'd mentioned that on your stalks, like you're really good at stalking these animals. Like 95% is like what you mentioned when you were talking mule deer. Maybe it isn't quite that, but what do you think your keys to like stalking these animals are? Is it like knowing what you can get away with and what you can't? Is it like moving really slow? Is it being aggressive when you see the opportunity? And it sounds like this last buck you stalked on his feet. So you must like be willing to stalk them on their feet or in their bed, or like, what do you think your keys to success when you're stalking these big mule deer are?
I combination of everything you mentioned, I think. Yep. like this last buck, I came in, I was kind of on a rise where I had a vantage point so I could pick him, you know, kind of survey the area. And as soon as I picked him out, I started in on him, made it about 10 yards and kind of realized like just no go. Like, maybe it would have worked, but I didn't like it. And so I eased back about 20 yards and then I sprinted probably 550, 600 yards, like full on sprint. I dropped my backpack area. It took me forever to find it because I didn't mark. I was focused on the deer, you know. So I dropped my backpack and I just carry my bow and I sprint like 250 yards back, 150 down, and then all the way back in until I'm almost in sight. And then I start my stalk from there. And I think being willing to lose ground, just kind of being, you know, surveying the area and looking, you know, what might benefit, you know, the area. That was early morning, so I had pretty good, still had downdraft. The thermals hadn't started picking up. And so I was able to cut back down around, come in from both lower on the hillside and down canyon from the buck. But then I knew I had to kind of hurry before the thermals switched on me. And so it just, I don't know, just adding it all together and making it roll and work. And
yeah, I hear you completely. It almost sounds like you just develop like such keen instincts, and then you're really listening to your instincts or listening to your gut with these trophy animals. Like, you've had all this experience guiding and hunting and things, and so you really seem to like, you're not over analyzing the situation or anything. You're just listening to your instincts. And when they tell you to go, you go. And when it tells you to move slow, you move slow. Like, it sounds like you've just really developed your hunting skills and listened to your instincts.
Yeah. Like, well, another example, I guess, would be I drew a hunt expo tag. I drew an archery elk tag on a pretty physical, tough unit. And I went down and I hunted the opening weekend. No luck. I actually kind of got sidetracked hunting a buck that I'd seen, and no luck on the deer. And then, you know, weather kind of came in. And so then I went back the first Friday of the end of the hunt. So we're like 5-6 days into the hunt, and my target bull, I went with one buddy, Brett Guyman. He's actually my cousin and owns the outfitter, Apex Outfitters, that I guide with. He was on the ridge spotting for me, and we hike out this ridge line. We sit down, I pull up my binoculars, like, holy crap, there's the target bull. But by the time we'd got out there, we didn't have enough daylight really. And I look at it and I pulled up on X and I look, and it was like 1.3 miles to the bull. And I had to go down, like, it was like 1400 vertical, then up about 400 vertical, side hill, and then up like another 100 vertical, like almost within sight of him. So that last 100 vertical feet is all that was really crucial. And I looked at the time, like, okay, I got like an hour and 10 minutes of shooting light. Like, I'm going. And so I took off running down the hill. Like, I tripped and ate it, rolled, got up, ran again. I got to that last 100 vertical feet and I had to just stop. I sat there, dry heaved a couple times. I thought about how dumb I was. And then, all right, I'm good to go. And eased up and ended up killing the bull. But that one, it was like a, you know, you just knew full tilt, clear till that last bit. And I, from where we were, we had no idea what the wind was doing other than just knowing generally, you know, it's the evening. He's up in this. You got these drainages coming down. Probably good. The wind's probably coming right down 100% in my favor if I go in the way that I'm thinking. And it all worked out. And I killed the bull. And he's still my biggest bull to date. So just, you know, that one was like a full bore just run. My first attempt at the bull and it worked. But yeah, like a lot of situational awareness, I guess. Just being willing to go full tilt when it's required and knowing when to maybe back out and come in from another angle. So
it's so it, man. Yeah, that's such full send. Yeah, it's like it's really fun. Like I've killed a lot of animals just from my ability to go for it, you know, and it doesn't always work out, but just giving yourself a chance, just going for it with no matter how far, what you got light left, like just looking at it and go, God, I'm just going to give myself a chance. And it's been a lot of times where I've arrowed animals because of it, but yeah, that's awesome. And I love like the honesty too, and like getting down in the bottom and dry heaving from your run. That's awesome, man. And then, yeah, like, I love those evening thermals. Like how predictable they can be when that sun sets and that air starts cooling and dropping. I've killed a lot of animals like on that downhill thermal, just knowing that I can count on that wind. In fact, it may be like my favorite time to kill elk is like that evening and that downhill thermal. But yeah, man, that's amazing. So you mentioned Apex Outfitting. It's probably tough to get you as a guide, but guys can reach out to Apex and maybe connect with you on some Utah hunts.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, Apex Outfitters, that's just a group of buddies. We've all guided for other people and done a lot of guiding over the years. Everyone that's a part of Apex Outfitters, then we kind of just decided we wanted to hunt as a group of buddies. We figured we could be more successful and, you know, do a better job both for ourselves and for the clients. And so, yeah, they reach out to Apex Outfitters or myself through my YouTube or through Instagram. And yeah, we can get anyone taken care of if they want to do a Utah hunt. So.
Oh, that's killer. Yeah, you run a great social media page, and I've been following along for years. So just really stoked to get you on the podcast and have an in-depth conversation, man. It's like you have so much knowledge of hunting these western game animals. So yeah, man, it's been super fun. Thanks for your time, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. It's great talking. And yeah, love to do it again sometime. So.
Oh, I'm going to hold you to that. Yeah, no, it was a great conversation. I really enjoyed it. So, yeah, thanks again for your time. Make sure to check him out on Instagram, his YouTube, and then also Apex Outfitting. So, yeah, thanks, Jace. We'll keep in touch.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay.
All right, guys, that's a wrap. Yeah, great conversation with Jace. Yeah, I really appreciate him coming on and sharing so much good information. So make sure to check out his YouTube, check out his guiding if you guys are interested in that. Also, his IG is JDG Sheds. So give him a follow on there as well. And yeah, we sure appreciate him taking the time and being on. I want to thank our sponsors for today's show. So, yeah, thanks to the guys over at Sig Sauer. Make sure you get entered into that drawing. There'll be a link in the description of the podcast wherever you listen to this podcast. Click on that. I believe it's just an email and you're entered in. Yeah, so thanks to those guys. Also want to thank Savage Arms, Black Ovis, and Camo Fire. Thanks to Eastman's for their support of the podcast. Again, another giveaway over on the Eastman's Bow Hunting Journal podcast over there. So check out that podcast from this week that's released on Wednesday. And yeah, we've got another giveaway going there. And everything we do over at Eastman. So yeah, we appreciate the support. Thanks for listening in this week. And yeah, got some good podcasts coming up for you guys that I'm really excited about, and some more that I'm recording. Got a couple this week. And so, yeah, just want to get you guys that good information, get you better for this upcoming fall, and also entertaining ones. So yeah, working hard at that to try to get some good recordings out to you guys. So stay tuned for that. And man, yeah, on my end, just getting in my runs, putting in for tags, shooting that bow, I think shooting sweet, that new lift. So, yeah, I'm stoked. getting out to do a little fishing here and there. And then, bear season is going to open up here in about 5 or 6 days. So pretty stoked to start getting after those things, see if I can't get a big boar arrow this season. So all good on my side. And, just enjoying things. I did the bear talk over there at the Montana Bow Hunters Association, went to the dinner there. So if you guys came to that, thank you for the support. And I think it went well. And I just think these state agencies, like I really like the HAL organization fighting for our hunting rights. I really like the Bow Hunters Association in these different states. And it's just a great place for my money and to support those guys as they fight for archery seasons and for archery huntings. And they really worked hard here in Montana to fight crossbows coming in during our archery seasons, which I think is important. So, thanks to those guys for that. And, keep on keeping on here. It's, time's flying by and get some work done and myself set up, and, it's going to be a really fun fall. I'm excited to see some of these draws come out, and, hopefully they pull my ticket or pull my name out of the hat. I'm able to draw some good tags here, but, starting to line up my season and, make sure I'm applied everywhere, and, it should be good. I'm looking forward to it, as I'm sure you guys are too. So thanks again for the support, listening in to the podcast. I really appreciate it. And with that, I'll check in with you guys next week.